I'm getting close.
Yeah, we're, as long as he's okay, I mean, I can stop anything.
I'm fine. So all I did from there on, this was back in, when was it? I think I was sure in 1982 with the home state. And so I teamed up with another fellow over in Walnut Creek, was it? I think it was Walnut Creek. Remember?
Oh,
Dave Cochran?
Uh-huh.
And he was basically an ex-engineer from a big company, and he decided to, he had four boys in college, you know, and he said, well, I asked him, when are you going to retire? He said, I'm not going to retire until I'm about 90. He said, I've got some college in college. But Dave and I hit it off just fine. And so we worked, idiotic things like, for example, a Swiss banknote company called him up. No, they called me up, that was it. And they said, well, we have to use copper sulfate, you know, CuSO4, 5H2O, and we're a little bit scared about putting it in water. I thought, it's got 5H2O in it already. But, so can you come down and advise us? I thought to myself, well, why not take a little tiny crystal and a teaspoon and a drop of water? If it doesn't block your face, you're in. But I thought, well, if I can make a few bucks, I'll do it. So I went for 2 days, for $250, telling them how to dissolve copper sulfate in water. That was, you might say, my first class in chemistry in high school. Most of this stuff has been high school chemistry that these idiots don't know, apparently. This is done for posterity, so these dear gentlemen don't know. But the degree of ignorance of the general population, particularly so-called educated population, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, just the most elementary of elementary chemistry. They don't know anything. It's incredible.
Are you still doing consulting work, or have
not
you?
Not anymore. I got so up to here with that. I mean, well, I had a case where there was some waitress in a cafe, it was a bar, she put a beer bottle down rather hard on the counter and exploded. And a shard hit her eye, and she was blinded temporarily. We got it out eventually. So my problem was, or my assignment was, why did the beer bottle explode? Well, it's perfectly obvious to me. It was it'd be sitting in the sun, for one thing I found out. The pressure inside, it was probably a defectively made beer bottle, or maybe it had a few more knocks en route, and there were some strains in the glass. And so one more knock just blew it, that was it. But I got some money out of that. Another one was a fellow bought a Chris Craft over down near Berkeley, it was in Berkeley Marine, I think. Big, beautiful yacht. And he'd somehow or other couldn't understand why a hole was developed in the gas tank. So, you know, sitting there in salt water, I thought, my goodness, you know what aluminum does in salt water. So anyway, I went over there and made depositions and so on in front of a whole bunch of attorneys and so on, and managed to solve that problem for him, because he was suing the person who had sold him this $50,000 or $60,000 boat. This was way back in the 80s, when 50 or 60 grand was a lot of money. Well, I suppose it is still. But it was much more in those days. It was incredible, the number of silly things I had to address myself to. But I did it, to make money. Well, anyway, it was during that period that I decided to get into the cell phone industry. And you might say, well, that's got nothing to do with chemistry, but it doesn't. But they were on TV saying, well, if you join this and your number gets selected, you could be a partner in a utility. And you could make millions. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. So we didn't have that much money, but 5,000 here, 2,500 there. I thought, well, you know, this chemistry is just not working out for me. I mean, on the West Coast, chemistry, it's not working. And I'm getting older, and nobody's going to hire a man in his 50s, and this, that, and the other. So I thought, well, I'm going to take a chance. So we scraped together just about everything we had, and we went into about 12 of these things, and we bombed, and our ball was not fixed in 10 of them. But I've always picked in two of them. Jean was in one of them. She won a little area called Montanaburg, Eight. It was out in the Jackrabbit country, and they wanted us to put up one of these cell phone towers. And then in those days, the government weren't, they weren't so silly. I mean, they knew that, I mean, 6 months a year, the concrete wouldn't set because it was frozen. But they weren't about to bend their rules. So there was just no time to put out a tower. So there was a fellow down in Texas we learned about, and he was borrowing up to the hilt. He was up $60 million in debt. He'd been buying all these cell phone companies from the Seattle area clear through to Minnesota, hoping he'd strike it rich somehow. So we sold her Montana number 8, and I think we got about $250,000 for it. So of course along comes good old IRS in the state of California, you know, and that was it. So I think we netted out of that, after a few bad investments in the stock market, about 90,000. So then of course the stock market started doing that anyway, right? But the other one, we decided to build it out, was Texas 9. Texas 9 was located about 180 miles southwest of Dallas-Fort Worth. Still pretty much out in the boonies, but a place called Brownwood, I think it was. Brownwood was a big area there. And even Brownwood's not very big, I mean, 8 or 10,000 people, but it extended all the way through, going east to a major highway from Houston, I think it was, all the way up to, I've never been to Texas, so I don't know, but if you look at the map, there's a main road going from, and our eastern edge of that, our little area, was right on the edge of that. And so we decided to build it out. And one of the fellows called Gary Samuels decided to find somebody who knew how to build out an area, and of course he was basically turned out to be a crook. His share of the company at that time was 6%. Mine was almost 6%, about 5.9. Well, by the time he managed to dilute, you know, and did that, he ended up with 12% of the company. I ended up with about 4.8. And he was doing it to everybody, so he was doing it to, he was ingratiating himself. It was basically a con man. But we were pleased to do it. So 15 years of, forgive the expression, pure undiluted hell, when we almost lost it because of misbehavior of the board of directors and so on and so forth. I finally, so to speak, metaphorically blew up, and I could see that what money we could have had was past disappearing. We did incorporate and we built it up, and he said by the year 2000 everybody will be having a dividend of about giving up about $5 million, according to their percentage equity. There were 21 people in the partnership. Well, I looked at our dividend, and our dividend was about our share of about not 5 million but 2.2 million. So when I plugged the curve with this, and it was doing this, I thought, this is going to bend over. So some people decided to start selling their shares. I sold a few of my shares, and you know, it still kept going. And finally, this fool wanted to send us deeper into debt. He thought we were doing so well that he wanted to buy the rural service area immediately below Texas 9, Texas 10. Which hadn't yet been built, which meant we'd have to build all those towers, go further into debt. And I thought, I don't know about this, I don't know at all. So finally I said, I've had enough of this. I mean, there was nothing but fighting and squabbling in this partnership. It was a terrible situation, wasn't it, Jeannie? Mm-hmm. We used to go over there and just dreading it. And there were three or four people there that were also like a clique, united against all the rest of us, and grabbing away everything they could from the rest of us. So anyway, it turned out that I said, look, I've had enough of this, we're heading for disaster. So I went to my attorney and said, look, I want you to write a blistering letter to these guys so that we can get rid of this darn thing, because people were buying up these things at the time. So he wrote up this sort of blistering letter in legalese, and so I said, look, put the following expression in the final paragraph. I said, Roy Neville is not about to be financially mugged on his way out of Lone Star. Financially mugged. And so we had this hyperloop thing, all of a sudden this financial mind. Well, we sent it to everyone in the partnership. And suddenly I learned about a week later there had been this huge explosion of partners who said, we better get rid of this thing, you know, Roy's decided to sell. And I also threatened to take to the SEC and the SEC and basically blow this whole can of worms wide open. So then we had a meeting. So we did sell 8 shares, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
And all we got out of that was about, about $375,000, something like that. And just to show what a rotten lot they were, they wouldn't tell us anything. The board of directors just, you know, they wouldn't let anything come out of the board of directors. Little did I know, that was in July we sold our shares. We could have gotten $750,000 easily. By November, we all had this meeting. We said, we went around the room, I go, went up to Gary Sanders. I know he's just going to throw a wrench in this thing. We went right past Gary, and finally, I was the last person to say, let's sell.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an offer of $130 million for it. So we ended up with about a little over $6 million. Not bad.
No.
Oh, if you could keep it. If you could keep it. But the IRS, as usual, you know, had nothing to do with it. It's one of the things I just hate about the IRS. You make $100,000 a year, they want their piece of the action. You lose $100,000, you can deduct it for $3,000 a year for the next 300-400 million years. They don't want to know you if you make a loss. But if you make a gain, they want their piece of pie. So anyway, we just walked over, what was it, about $2 million or something, but just over $2 million, if we had almost nothing to write it against. Anyway, we were in the top bracket, and it was closer to $3 million. I didn't like to think about it, it was just too painful. So anyway, I thought, well, here we are at the end of life, and we've had a grueling business through chemistry, and now we're getting a grueling business through these people. I said, life is pretty tough. So anyway, then I decided I was still cuddling in my library and so on, and I was getting very tired. I mean, by then I was, what, about 76?
Mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't that. No, I wasn't that old. I'm sorry, I was about 71. Do you want to change the tape? I've got to go to the bathroom.
Okay, well, I'm not ready.
Yeah.
How far did we get?
He's coming back tomorrow. I told him about 1 o'clock.
Oh, yes, I remember. It was about 19... what was it now? It was 1998, February the 25th of 1998. Is that right? Yeah. The day before Norma's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I got up in the middle of the night. Now, mind you, I should backtrack about my health. Gene and I went over to England in 92, and I had been having chest pains. And by the time I got over there, I was having severe chest pains. And it's a long flight, and we'd have a 2-hour delay at San Francisco, and then plus a long flight, and no sleep, and so on. And anyway, I was all set to go to the book fair in London. And we were standing this very, very long, long line there in 92. And I said, I've just got to go and sit down. It's really hurting. I felt like about a 300-pound man was standing in my chest. And so anyway, I sat down. Of course, the line gradually moved on. Some porter or whatever he was came and said, sir, you've got to get back in line. So I said, I'm really feeling pretty rotten. I said, I've got pain in my chest. So he said, you've got to go and see the doctor. So there was an Indian doctor there. The lady doctor with this big red dot, you know, I don't know what they call this thing, but anyway. And she said, oh, you've got to go to the hospital right away. So she had this sorry, is that the word they used?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I said, no, I can't do that. My cousin's going to meet me here. And anyway, what happened was that I finally, they whisked it out of the line, opened up a special place for us to go through. And we got checked in. Oh, sure, boom, 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 boom. We were there instead of waiting there. But I got taken back now. I was taken back where? To Norman, wasn't I?
Yeah, you went to Norman. Norman's there.
My cousin, Norman, and I spent, 2 days there, was it? And I was in pain still, but less pain. So I walk up the street and sit in the park there and come back and so on. But it was really awful. So finally he drove us down, didn't he, to Christian, my other cousin, down near Bournemouth, just east of Bournemouth. And so I spent about 3 or 4 days there, and we took a few little day trips out. I remember they liked to go out for a nice walk on the beach. And what happened, of course, they're younger than me, but, well, she's 11 years younger than me, and he's about 8 years younger than me, but they strode off up the beach and so on. I was thinking, oh, this is getting awful. Down the ramp there onto the beach. And finally, to my old fossil hunting beds. Can you hear this all right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was walking on ahead, and I thought, I'm going to die on Barton Beach, I just know this. Mm-hmm. So finally, I found a few fossils, not particularly good ones, and I had to walk back, and of course they had this big ramp up there, so finally, staggered up that ramp, and it was getting really fierce. And so, let's see what happened. I'm trying to get the right sequence here. I got to the top, I sat down, and so on, and they took us home, didn't they? We walked home slowly. Got in the car and went home. Wasn't that the time I went to the doctor the next day?
Let's see. You didn't go to the doctor.
No. The very next day, we were supposed to go up to York.
Yeah.
So anyway, we went to Bournemouth Central Station, got on the train, and went all the way up to York. Now, have you ever been to York?
No.
Well, it's not a straight through thing. It's one of these curved stations like that. And where the train actually arrives is here. And there's a big iron bridge that goes over the track and down the other side and then up to the town. I had packed a great big suitcase all ready to go to York and then finally down to London. I went to York, by the way, to see this very good book dealer friend of mine. And so anyway... I'm trying to get this in the right sequence. I lugged this great big suitcase up over the iron bridge, across and down the other side. And finally, I was in a state of collapse almost, wasn't I?
Mm-hmm.
So we hailed a taxi, and he took us just what was not more than about 6 blocks,
mm-hmm.
right to this book dealer's place, and went in there. And I didn't want to just introduce myself being practically a cripple, you know. I sat there in agony, had lunch. And then finally, we talked about books and things like that, and then had dinner. I took them out to dinner at the, what's the name of that place again?
I don't remember the name of that.
The Jorvik Hotel.
Oh yeah, Jorvik Hotel.
Yeah, overlooking the ruins of some old abbey there. Anyway, he said, well, why don't we go for a walk along the River Ouse? Mm-hmm. That is, right, isn't it, Ouse?
Yeah.
So he's a big tall man, he's about 6'4" or 6'5". His wife's tall, we're a couple of shorties. So anyway, we took his dog for a swim along the river. Ooh, so they were striding off and we were trying to keep up, and of course his pain came back with a vengeance. And gee, I don't know when we'd even be able to get back to the hotel. So anyway, I finally told him I wasn't feeling all that great. So, I mean, I knew this deal fairly well, but not so well as I could, you know, really open up to him. And so we finally got back to the hotel. I had a pain you wouldn't believe. And so I sat down in the little vestibule there. I said, I can't go up to my room yet. There's only one flight up. So as we were sitting there, all of a sudden Barbara came back, and he had forgotten, I think, his glasses or something, because we'd had him there at the Jorvik Hotel. He said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I've got this awful pain. So Daniel was his name. He said, I'll tell Daniel. So anyway, in the meantime, we went up there and I lay down, and for maybe about an hour, the pain gradually subsided. It was still there, but it was not as intense. So finally, he comes into the room. He said, I brought the doctor with me. In those days, and over there you can do that, bring the doctor to the patient. Over here you have to drag the patient, you know, he's half dead, to the doctor. Anyway, the doctor came in and he said, you've got to go to York Hospital right away. I said, I'm supposed to go to the book fair tomorrow in London. He said, no, the book fair's out. He said, you won't go to York Hospital. You should be there for at least 4 days of observation. I said, I come all the way to England for 4 days in York Hospital. No way. So anyway, we talked about it, and he said, well, if you go back down there to your cousin on the South Coast and just rest for the rest of your time here for another 2.5 weeks, then you can go back to America and see your own doctor. Much to say, if you can make it. So anyway, so that's what I did. And Dan was nice enough, we took a fast train right down there, and he took us across London to the other train at Waterloo and down to Bournemouth. And so we got up there, and Chris picked us up. I basically spent the other 2.5 weeks on the couch. Mm-hmm. Wonderful vacation. And we did manage to get down to stores and, you know, places I knew so well, but and there was nothing new to Gene or me. We'd been there before. So anyway, I finally, you tried to come back on the airplane, didn't you, to cancel the flight and all that. They wanted to charge more than double what they charged one way.
Yeah.
It was just awful. So anyway, so finally, I said, I'm not going to do that. So finally we got on the plane and we came back, and they told the people at the airport to have a wheelchair ready for me, so I was feeling kind of like some old dollar, you know. But I thought, well, who cares? No one knew me anyway. So I was wheeled on the plane, and I got back there and wheeled off the plane. Jenny was there, her daughter, to meet us and so on. Anyway, I saw the doctor the next day, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, what was his name?
Reichel,
that was it. And he said, well, he said, we're going to have to operate and give you a bypass. So I said, what exactly do you do? So he said, well, we cut you open, we open up like a book, we take your heart out, and we do this and we do that, cut veins on the leg. And I said, what am I supposed to be breathing in? Oh, we got on a machine. I said, well, my luck. There'll be a power failure or something. I'll be dead, you know. So anyway, he put such a scare into me that I decided not to do anything. He said, well, I can give you some medicine. So anyway, he gave me some medicine. He took me, I went in for several more EKGs, and he said, I think it's beginning to get all right again. So anyway, we then in the meantime, he retired. I went to a different cardiologist. And two of them, wasn't it when we got mixed up with
Selman
and Vetter, that's right. Anyway, they both said, well, you know what's happening? Yes, you've got partly plugged arteries, but you're growing what they call collaterals around your partly plugged arteries. And I said, well, you know, I can walk up and down the street now and I don't even have a pain anymore. So he said, well, probably it's cured itself. Well, how wrong they were. So anyway, finally, that got me from about 92 to 98. All right, picture this. I'm in bed, 4 o'clock in the morning, I have to get up and go to the bathroom. I told Jeannie, I said, I'm feeling really rotten, I feel like I want to vomit. She said, so I went to the bathroom, came back, and I said, Jeannie, I think I'm going to faint. She said, okay, I'll call 911. So she rushes out. I said, I don't want people clumping in here at 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, no. So I finally fainted. Now, next thing I knew, it seemed like about 5 minutes later, I saw this huge man walking, I know, big, burly guys. What's wrong? What seems to be the problem, sir? I said, I think I'm going to vomit. Can you get to the bathroom, sir? I said, no, I can't. There was a little metal waste basket there. No, it wasn't metal, it was plastic. And I vomited 2 pints of blood. I remember saying, oh my God, I sprung a leak. That was my exact quote. I said, now I've got to go to the hospital. Oh, I hate hospitals. Oh, Lord, now. No more night's sleep. Poke, prod. Oh. Because, you know what, you can't get any rest in the hospital. So anyway, I was whisked off to the emergency room, and I was there for, 2 hours before I could actually get a room assigned to me. I was put in this room. There was this guy. You must understand, I've got this pretty sense of humor. I can see it. Even in a deadliest of situations, you always sort of see the funny side. There was this poor old man, what I call hocking up the other lung, you know. Next minute, and oh, isn't this delightful? And so I hadn't been in bed more than about 5 minutes, and I guess my stomach sort of partly full of blood again, and I remember looking, there was blood all over there.
but a square yard of blood.
Dr. Barrett just happened to be passing the door. You were not in the room. I was alone with the other man, the guy with the car. And he said, what was it? Take him immediately to, where was it now?
ICU,
intensive care unit. All right, and I was pretty much, you know, I was given an infusion of blood, what do you call it?
IV.
An IV, of course. And after they typed my blood on to Tybo, you know. And so I was, and I did go back to that room. So the next thing we knew was I was told I was going to have a stomach operation. So I was prepared for the stomach operation. And it turned out after 2.5 hours, they couldn't find what was the problem. Well, I later learned through the doctor, what was the doctor's name? A Polish name.
Unpronounced.
Z's and Y's. Anyway, he was a good doctor. And he told me, he said, you know, now I've been taking 2 baby aspirins to sort of thin my blood, you know, stop blood clumping together and so on. And what had happened, apparently, is one of the baby aspirins had gone down there, and you know, your stomach is full of little, it's not smooth, little ridges and things like that. What they thought was that a piece of that aspirin had gotten caught in one of those ridges, and somehow had bored its way or dissolved its way through the wall and hit an artery. So they said, with every pump of your heart, most of it's going down the artery, and a little bit was squirting into your stomach. Which accounted for why I irked up the blood to start with, and several hours went by, irked up another lot. And anyway, Jean had kept that little waste paper by themselves. I'm not turning you off or anything, right?
No.
And when I finally got home, we measured it with literally about 2 pints of that deep. And you know, as a scientist, I thought, isn't that funny? You know, they used other plates to grow bacteria, and there was nothing growing on it. Nothing, no fungus, nothing. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was too acidic. So I just knew what. Maybe the pH was wrong. But anyway, I remember my son-in-law. I said, "Look, you've got to empty this." And he said, "Well," and he's not a particularly educated man. He said, "You're grossing me out, man." Anyway, he emptied it in the toilet. But anyway, I had this, they managed to stitch me up and so on, and this great big tear in my stomach in while they'd open me up. Well, afterwards, when I finally sort of came more or less conscious, I sort of remember this being on the gurney there, and Betta said to me, he said, "We're taking you for an angioplasty, is that right? Mm-hmm. Is that the right word?
That's it.
Yeah.